Iran and Oman assigned several memorandums of understanding and cooperation programs in sectors including oil and gas and transportation during the Iranian president's visit to Muscat. Moscow has accused the West of triggering a global food crisis as a result of anti-Russia sanctions. And China warns the U.S. that it has no room for compromise or concessions on matters related to its sovereignty or territorial integrity. Hello, everyone. Very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi is in Oman on an official visit where expansion of bilateral cooperation tops his agenda. Raisi was welcomed by Oman Sultan Haytham bin Tariq at his official Al Alam Palace. Following Raisi's arrival, Iran and Oman signed 12 cooperation documents and memorandums of understanding. These include cooperation in energy, transportation, industrial, and trade sectors. Documents were signed by a number of Iranian ministers, including top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdollahian and their Omani counterparts. Raisi's trip to Muscat is part of the Iranian government's efforts to strengthen ties with neighboring countries. Earlier, we were joined by chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to region and beyond. And so, therefore, it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
Speaking prior to his trip to Oman, Iran's president ordered a serious investigation into the assassination of a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. Ebrahim Raisi has pledged to avenge the killing of Colonel Sayed Khodai. Raisi said arrogant world powers were involved in the crime. IRGC, a colonel, was assassinated in his car in front of his home in Tehran on Sunday. He was shot five times by two motorcyclists. Iran's foreign ministry has described the assassination as a terrorist operation and an inhumane crime. The ministry said it is regrettable to see countries claiming to be fighting terrorism silent on this assassination. Russia has accused the West of triggering a global food crisis by imposing the severest sanctions on Russia over its military operations in Ukraine.
We are not the source of the problem. The source of the problem that leads to world hunger are those who impose sanctions against us and the sanctions themselves.
The Kremlin spokesman also blamed Ukraine for making commercial shipping impossible by mining its waters. Peskov underlined Russia has not shut off Ukraine's grain exports to Poland despite Western weapons being delivered to Kiev. A UN Food Agency official had previously said more than 25 million tons of grain was stuck in Ukraine due to lack of infrastructure and a sea blockade. More than 36 countries are now facing food insecurity issues as they rely heavily on wheat imports from Russia and Ukraine. Ongoing war and the West's anti-Russia measures have pushed up prices of commodities ranging from cooking oil and fertilizer to energy in many countries. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for maximum sanctions against Russia, including an oil embargo over the Ukraine war.
This is what the sanction should be. There should be maximum so that Russia and every other potential aggressor who wants to wage a brutal war against its neighbor would clearly know the immediate consequences for their actions. And I believe there are still no such sanctions against Russia. And there should be. There should be Russian oil embargo. All the Russian banks should be blocked. No exceptions. There should be an abandonment of the Russian IT sector. There should not be any trade with Russia. This should be a precedent for sanctions pressure that will work convincingly for the decades to come.
Zelensky issued the call during a virtual speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He urged all foreign businesses still operating in Russia to immediately withdraw from there and instead put their money into rebuilding Ukraine. Zelensky also called for more arms supplies to Ukraine, saying that Kiev needs all the weapons that it's asked for, not just the ones that have been provided. Western countries, spearheaded by Washington, have been pouring billions of dollars in military assistance into Ukraine since Russia began its military operation in late February. They've also imposed several rounds of sanctions against Moscow. In response, Russia has blacklisted hundreds of Western individuals and diplomats. An exclusive report, our correspondent in Ukraine, Johnny Miller, investigates the alleged single most deadly war crime of the conflict so far.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theater.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement. He wouldn't speak on camera, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
Behind me, just over there, is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
And now China has lashed out at the U.S. after President Joe Biden said that Washington will defend Taiwan militarily if Beijing invades the self-ruled island.
We deplore and reject the U.S. remarks. Taiwan is an inimitable part of the Chinese territory. The Taiwan issue is purely China's internal affair, which won't stand for any foreign interference. Issues bearing on China's core interests, including the sovereignty and territorial integrity, there's no room for compromise or concession. No one should underestimate the Chinese people's firm resolution, will, and capability to defend its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and should not stand against the 1.4 billion Chinese people.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman also called on the U.S. to earnestly abide by the One China principle and refrain from supporting Taiwan's independence. The official warned Washington that its meddlesome approach will harm bilateral ties. China has time and again warned the U.S. against increasing military and political support for Taiwan. China considers the island as part of its territory. At least five people are dead after sections of an unfinished building collapse in southwestern Iran. Some 27 people have so far been pulled out from under rubble and taken to area hospitals. A 10-story structure came down at around midday in downtown Abadan. Search and rescue efforts are underway. There are fears the number of casualties will rise, with reports saying up to 50 people are still trapped under debris. The collapse took place and blocked the city's busiest road, with surrounding buildings evacuated. An investigation is underway to determine the cause of this collapse. The building owner and contractor have both been detained. In Australia, Labor leader Anthony Albanese has been sworn in as Prime Minister, ending nearly a decade of Conservative-led rule in the country. Albanese and four of his ministers took the oath of office after his party won national elections Saturday. Albanese takes the helm hours before a summit in Tokyo with Japanese, Indian, and U.S. leaders as part of the so-called Quad Group. He said the summit is an absolute priority for his country and an opportunity to send a message of change to the world. He said he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish in policy terms.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together, look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and a robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks.
Australia's new Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has vowed to mend Canberra's relations with the world and sweep aside the country's reputation as a climate damager. Albanese has also said he will unite the country, especially due to anger over climate change after some of the worst floods and fires hit the country in recent months.
Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Check the map. This is the map of Iran. You know, I still stick to these paper maps and have no interest in the digital maps. This map is a gift from my father. I've been keeping it for a long time. I've marked all the points I visited. Now, another mark. A new mark. Basht County. Found it. Here it is. A circle around the location. Guess what? Tomorrow I'm going to visit a spectacular ancient Iranian monument. Dogur Dopa. Dogur Dopa is an ancient monument located in Basht County in Kohgiloye and Boyerahmad province. This monument was registered in Iran's National Heritage List in 2001. Basht is also one of the historical and ancient cities of Iran. This city dates back to Elami period. Elam was an ancient civilization centered in southwest of Iranian plateau at the end of the 3rd millennium BC. Basht County has a mild weather. People of this city are mostly active in the fields of agriculture, gardening, and animal husbandry. Dogur Dopa are two stone columns made of milky white limestone, which are deliberately carved. These columns were used as mil, or guide tower, which was a kind of a structure with fire on them so that the travelers could find their way. Some archaeologists believe that these columns date back to the Sasanid era. This morning, I arrived at Basht County, and right now, I am in a very beautiful plain. Here's full of anemone flowers as well as oregano. Further away, there is a hill where on its top, the stone columns of Dogur Dopa are situated. Well, I have to take a walk in order to reach these historical structures. And what's more enjoyable than hiking in a green, beautiful plain? Just a few meters left to top of that hill. I can see the columns. Yeah, visible.
Oh, God. Look at this. Two milky white columns next to each other. Exactly next to each other. They are integrated and have bulges on their top. In order to have a clear image of these two columns, just imagine two nails with the height of 2 meters. The distance between the two columns is 0.5 meter. One of the columns is a little bit shorter than the other one. One of the locals told me that these two columns were used as a guide for travelers even in 50 years ago. Further away from the columns of Dogurdopa, there are orange gardens. These gardens have doubled the beauty of these ancient structures. Let me get seated beneath these orange trees and look at the spectacular monuments of Iran from this point of view. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Economic divide.
The U.S. dollar has been regarded as the world's number one currency, but it is being challenged like no other time in history. Not only is there a possibility of a new financial system that is being formed, more and more countries are opting to do their bilateral trade in their own currencies. One country, Brazil, is even considering forming a regional currency to break away from the dollar dependency. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of today's program. First, a weakening U.S. dollar. A depreciation has taken place since 2020. Inflation also has occurred, which is pointing to a U.S. economic downturn. That will contribute to the U.S. dollar weakening. Next, we will take a look at new global monetary order. One of them, CBDC, digitized domestic currency. That's regulated by the central banks, and that again contributes to a move towards de-dollarizing. And another highlight of the program, a new currency. Brazil's Lula da Silva, future presidential candidate, wants a new regional LATAM currency to break away from the dollar. Will that work?
The U.S. dollar is continuing down its path of losing its appeal as the number one currency of choice. There are many countries who are working hard to de-dollarize, especially when it comes to bilateral trade. BRICS countries are one grouping of countries that have started down this path from a long time ago, especially countries like Russia and China. Certain SCO member countries, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, are also conducting bilateral trade in their own currency. This includes countries like Russia, China, India, and Iran. Some of the reasons are not to have the long arm of U.S. sanctions reach these countries. Russia is a case in point. The unprecedented U.S. sanctions against this country, with the aim of destroying its economy, is having devastating effects in different sectors. But more importantly, when the U.S. confiscated Russia's dollar currency in foreign banks, that was a nail in the coffin for the dollar. Other countries have taken note and are dumping the dollar for other currencies in case they do not oblige to U.S. foreign policy directives. and Russia's ruble gain in value is another example of how the U.S. dollar is losing its appeal. Given that Russia is backing that with gold and not printer ink like the dollar, it has surpassed in value against the dollar. The U.S. monetary system using the dollar as a weapon is being threatened in its efficiency, and then the dollar standing in more ways than one. The U.S. insistence to keep this war going, for example, on Ukraine, doesn't help matters either for the U.S. These are what some people thought online about this and whether there is a new monetary system competing with the U.S. Our first post, recent U.S. government actions will lead investors to diversify away from U.S. markets. U.S. bonds will lose safe haven status, and America's credibility will be lost. BRICS and others will buy OPEC's oil. Next up, a house of cards. The U.S.'s trade deficit is sustained by the dollar status as world reserve currency. Under normal circumstances, a country that does not produce real value collapses. When the dollar collapses, Americans will get squeezed harder. And then this post, sanctions are destroying the U.S. dollar's status as the world's top currency. Sanctions are destroying the dollar status because the continual use of sanctions to pressure countries and companies perceived to be acting against U.S. interests may also be weakening the dollar's global position. It goes on to say the convenience of simply prescribing sanctions as a one-size-fits-all is losing its effect and at the same time empowering the opposition. And in our final post, what people said, Lula hopes to see the creation of a Latin American currency in order to end the dollar dependency. Let me introduce our guest for this segment of the Q&A. We have Joe Emmersberger, who's an author, freelance writer at fair.org, who joins us. Okay, welcome to the program, Joe Emmersberger. Looking at how most economies are establishing different mechanisms to circumvent, for example, U.S. sanctions, and also the hegemony of the U.S. dollar, these range from like using barter trade to trading in other currencies, of course, national currencies. And also, we're looking at the world moving towards multipolarity. Isn't it only a matter of time before the dollar, for example, loses its dominance when it comes to global currencies?
Yes, I think that's correct, but it's a question of how much time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. I think it'll still take years. A lot will depend on what China does. For example, there's a rush, there's initiatives in China to develop more digital currency, more modernized banking system.
Let me introduce Cesar Locatelli, an economist and independent journalist who joins us. Cesar Locatelli, welcome to Economic Divide. The future Brazilian presidential candidate, Lula da Silva, has actually proposed a move away from the dollar or to have the dollar dominance to be decreased or lessened when it comes to not just Brazil but regional countries. And its introduction, he has introduced what's called a SOR. But it says regional countries can still use their currencies. What do you think about that when it comes to the introduction of a local currency in order to move away from the dollar? Because some countries are actually using their own currencies when it comes to bilateral trade.
Well, I'll say the same thing. It will help. We have to consider that in this case, I'm sorry for that.
Well, that's okay.
In this case, the roles the dollar plays as a medium of exchange in an international unit of value.
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. This is where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Well, our first topic takes us to the UK. Britons there are facing what's called a real food poverty. That is a warning that has been issued by a supermarket giant in that country. And that supermarket is Tesco, where Tesco's boss says people in the UK are actually struggling with the cost of living crisis. That comes, of course, on top of the inflation that that country is experiencing. And talk about inflation, let's go to the EU and see how inflation is doing cumulatively therefore the bloc. The ninth EU country is actually seeing inflation jump to double digits. So you have nine countries in the 27-member bloc to experience inflation. Greece, in this case, has recorded its highest price increases in 28 years. So inflation is gripping the EU like many other parts of the world. Next up, limited energy supplies. Yes, that is a warning that has been issued by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who have said that the world's dwindling energy supplies is what's occurring. They added that spare capacity is decreasing in all energy sectors, and this has happened in the wake of Russia's war on Ukraine. So when you have Saudi Arabia in particular issuing that kind of warning, first, to find out if that's true or not, if it is, very important. And secondly, we have to find out if there's actually politics involved in that warning. Finally, market sell-off. That's right. That is what has happened in this past week in the U.S. The S&P 500, the Dow Jones, suffering steep losses. Aside from those two major markets in the U.S., you also have the cryptocurrency market, which has lost more than half of its value. Now, as of the recording of this program, Bitcoin was actually below 30,000, which is roughly about half of its value. Okay, those were the stories that we found to be important in our view. If you have a story in your part of the world that you would like for us to cover in this program, please don't hesitate to drop us a line and tell us what that is. Contact information is on your screens now.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The world is moving towards a multipolar financial world. Some argue that it is here already. So is it or is it not? Can the U.S. financial system and the dollar survive it? That is what we'll be looking at closely in our in-depth section. Well, first things first. What is a multipolar financial system anyways? Well, in short, it is a system which will have a monumental occurrence. It will cause what's called de-dollarization. Basically, a multipolar financial system will arise due to a shock in the U.S. that causes a migration away from its currency. Next, for the U.S. dollar to actually lose its standing, it is widely believed that one of the major factors that will lead to that outcome will come from within the U.S., like the U.S. debt. Now, the U.S. debt ceiling comes into focus here, is the maximum amount of money that the United States can borrow by issuing bonds. But what if the figure was this? I mean, it's even hard to decipher what we're looking at here. $30 trillion as of when we're speaking is what this figure is. It's actually $30 trillion plus, $448 million to add to that, and counting. Although the cap on public borrowing has always been lifted just in time to avert a default, the failure of the U.S. to pay its debt would dent its attractiveness as a reserve asset. So that is something that many central banks are actually looking at. Taking a look at another factor that points to a break from the dollar are how countries are actually shedding the dollar from the reserves and opting to go for gold. Now, central banks around the world are increasing the gold that they are holding in foreign exchange reserves. This is a snapshot of that. Kazakhstan, Turkey, Russia of note because of the war that's going on. And then moving down, China is also another country to be looking at in terms of their gold reserves. This actually has brought the total to a 31-year high for the year 2021 in terms of the countries holding the gold reserves. Now, the value of the dollar against gold has dropped sharply over the last decade, and this reflects global concerns about the dollar-based monetary regime. It is worth noting the amount of gold reserves which exist underground, and here is the current supply. What countries actually have that amount? Well, coming in first is Australia at 19% of the world in terms of having the most, 10,000 tons. Again, of note, Russia, which has 7,500 tons, then U.S., Peru, and then the rest of the world coming in at 51%. Now, when you take a look at Russia, it holds the second most gold reserves, more than double that of the U.S., coming in a short second behind Australia, which poses two questions. How can the U.S. think it can break Russia economically? And two, Russia can surely give the dollar a run for the money since, for example, the ruble is backed by gold, unlike the dollar. Well, since we have mentioned the currency, the ruble, then let's talk about the reserve currencies of central banks. They are more than ever before looking to diversify away from the dollar. And here is just a snapshot of some of the currencies around the world, such as the pound, or you're looking at the euro, or even the yen. And, of course, this is meant for the central banks to have a more diverse set of assets to move away from the amount of dollars they use. And it's especially true for emerging markets, where much of the demand for reserve assets is going to come from, which means more euros, renminbis, and maybe even stable coins, which will be held alongside what many say is still a popular U.S. dollar. All right, next up, the next order of the day is something that's rattled financial markets and is set to be the defining moment. And we're looking at a decentralized finance. Stable coins as a reserve currency is one of the features. And basically, that means that there are no controls by central banks. And that means that they cannot see where money is coming from in the form of digital currencies. Of course, some of the popular ones are cryptocurrencies. They are the ones that have contributed to its popularity. Next up, CBDCs, their central bank digital currency. And in this case in point, these are ones that are issued by the central banks. Now, the digital yuan helped China internationalize this currency, and that is something that's very important for the yuan. Next up, the Latin American currency, the SUR, is something that the future presidential candidate, Lula da Silva, has actually proposed. And basically, the ultimate goal is to decrease the dependence on the U.S. dollar. That is something that Lula da Silva is proposing, because this way the U.S. will not have control over the country overall in terms of the politics that's involved. And of course, the U.S. will then not be able to use the dollar, as some say, as a weapon. Okay, let's get some analysis into the picture. Let me bring in our guest, Joe Emmersberger, who's an author, freelance writer at fair.org, who rejoins us. Joe, welcome back. So when we take a look at the proposal that the future Brazilian candidate Lula da Silva has said, that is for the country, in particular Brazil, to be free from the dollar, and then the regional countries by proposing this regional currency. Do you think it's going to work? I mean, this is, in terms of bilateral trade, he says the countries can keep their own currencies. But overall, what do you think about that scheme? Because countries already are using their own currencies in bilateral trade, like Iran, India, or Russia and China.
Well, all those are very positive initiatives, but I think the key thing to keep in mind is that the U.S. dollar is so dominant that it'll still take years for that to really make an appreciable a dent in the U.S. financial dominance. It's going in the right direction, but it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. This is something that hopefully the countries that were under U.S. attack will not lose momentum and will not get in any way complacent about circumventing the U.S. financial system and broadening all these initiatives you talk about. But it's huge. A huge factor here is what China does.
Yeah, indeed. We're going to be looking out for that. Well, let's bring back Cesar Lucatelli, economist and independent journalist, who rejoins us. Welcome back, Cesar. Saudi Arabia had announced earlier that it is actually shedding some of its dollars, and it actually is going to sell some of its oil to China by pegging the oil sales to the yuan. What do you think about that? I mean, doesn't that, in essence, actually make the dollar lose its standing by changing its currency to the yuan?
The transactions being made in another currency other than the dollar will help debilitate the dollar. On the other hand, it seems, I don't know if I'm correct, but this change will follow the new geopolitical status of the world.
Brazil's former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has launched his presidential candidacy for this October's election, calling for unity around democracy. He's also vowed to fix the country's economy hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, Lula has proposed creating a Latin American currency in order to combat the dependency on the dollar. Lula da Silva has proposed expanding Latin American economic integration through the creation of a common regional currency. He says Latin American countries should use a unified regional currency. He revealed that the currency would be called the Sur, which means south in Spanish. Lula explained that countries in Latin America could still keep their sovereign domestic currency, but they could use the Sur to do bilateral trade with each other instead of having to exchange for U.S. dollars. The Sur could also help to contain inflation in the region. Lula said the goal of the currency would be to deepen Latin American integration and to strengthen the region's economic sovereignty, weakening its dependence on the U.S. Lula has also vowed to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture in order to challenge the Western financial hegemony. Five countries represent 41% of the global population, 24% of the global gross domestic product, and 16% of the global trade. Lula, who led Brazil through an economic boom from 2003 to 2010, has been in unofficial campaign mode since March of last year. He left office 12 years ago with approval ratings of 87% after presiding over a golden period that lifted some 30 million Brazilians out of poverty.
When it comes to the dollar, there are many factors that contribute to its strong standing, and the one that stands out the most is how oil is pegged to the dollar. Most oil-exporting nations own their oil industries. That makes their national income dependent on the dollar's value. If it falls, so does their government's revenue. As a result, most of these oil exporters have pegged their currencies to the dollar. Now, we know that the relationship between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the US is on the rocks since both, as a part of OPEC, did not comply with Washington's demands to boost production. Well, things have actually turned for the worse. After getting snubbed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia and OPEC, the US is heading back. The US Senate committee has passed an antitrust bill pressuring OPEC. This bill could open OPEC and partners to lawsuits for collusion or boosting crude oil prices. That is because before, OPEC countries had immunity that protected them and its national oil companies from lawsuits. US lawmakers say that NOPEC is intended to protect US consumers and businesses from engineered spikes in the cost of gasoline, something which the US is accusing OPEC member countries of doing, although it's not saying that to them directly. As was expected, OPEC did not take this sitting down and has hit back, which could put a further strain on the US and, in turn, gasoline prices. The UAE energy minister issued a warning to the US that the NOPEC bill could disrupt the industry's long-standing system of production and increase prices by 300% or even higher. Sohail Al-Mazrui said OPEC is being unfairly targeted, adding, "If you hinder the system, you need to watch what you're asking for, because having a chaotic market, you would see a 200% or 300% increase in the prices that the world cannot handle." Here's how OPEC stands on the issue of boosting production on March 30th, before the war between Russia and Ukraine started, from the mouth of the Saudi oil minister.
"I would take that privilege of saying I've been at it for the last 35 years, and I know how we managed to compartmentalize our political differences from what is good for the common good or the common good of all of us."
Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they try to remain neutral. They try to remain in the gray area between those who impose sanctions on Russia and, of course, the other side is Russia. However, that also has many economic reasons behind it. I don't think OPEC producers, they want to seem allies of the United States when it comes to how much oil they produce.
All of this is, of course, bad news for the U.S., which is experiencing record oil prices. And with the war on Russia showing no signs of it ending anytime soon, oil production will not be increased the way the U.S. wants.
Europe's reliance on Russian energy is so high that you cannot easily wean off of it without having a significant economic impact in the region.
Why does this matter? Because the country that the U.S. made a deal to peg oil to the dollar, Saudi Arabia, is in active talks with Beijing to price some of its oil sales to China in the yuan. The talks have actually accelerated as the Saudi unhappiness has grown with Washington, surely to grow even more due to the NOPEC bill that was passed. This would dent the U.S. dollar's dominance of the global petroleum market and mark another shift by the world's top crude exporter toward Asia. That does it for my section. Hope it was informative for you.
In this program, we have outlined for you all the ways that the U.S. monetary system is being squeezed or challenged, I should say, including the dollar. Now, there's no doubt that countries are tired, in some sense, of the dependency on the dollar. For example, when it comes to the fact that the U.S. may exercise sanctions against them if they don't bend politically for the U.S. But all eyes are on China, then oil-producing countries, if they are going to accelerate their plans for pegging the oil sales to the yuan, for example. Saudi Arabia has done a portion of its sales that way. Add to that the multipolar financial system, which includes digital currencies. Well, the U.S. then has a lot to worry about, especially vis-a-vis the dollar. That does for this edition of the program. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mika Vitavi and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.